try this thing again.
Try this one more time. Second time's a charm? Mm-hmm. Something like that.
I guess so.
Hi. What's up?
Not much.
You? What's happening? Not much. Nope. Not much.
Cool. Who are you?
I'm Marguerite Virginia. Who are you?
I'm Emily Klein, and we are the co-hosts of, I almost said, This American Life. God, I wish.
Guest hosting This American Life.
This is Emily Klein filling in for Ira Glass.
And Marguerite filling in for the other
person. Filling in for, wait, on the on Parks and Recreation, this is so-and-so filling in for so-and-so who is filling in for so-and-so who went on vacation 6 months ago. But we are your co-hosts for Millennial Poet Society.
That's what it is.
That's what you're here to listen to. Mm-hmm. That's the name of our game. And we're glad you tuned in this week. We've got a doozy of an episode for you.
It's going to be great. We're very excited because we got tickets to see some special people.
Guess who? It's two of our favorites.
We've talked about it before. Sarah Kay and Phil Kay from Project Yay. Voice. We're so excited. They're going to be in New York City next weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah, next weekend. And mm-hmm. I was like, wait, is it this weekend?
No.
And we're so, so excited. We got tickets. And it's going to be an awesome time. It's literally like the dream.
It truly is. Like, the only thing that could make it better is like if Rupi and Clementine decided to make guest appearances.
Oh, my God. And Clementine is in New York now.
I would probably cry a lot if they just, like, all dropped did a in. Thing together.
They won't. I know. This, at least.
But can you just, like, imagine?
Yeah.
Ugh.
We should hit Clementine up and be like, hey.
Be like, hey, you want a guest on our podcast? We only talk about you all the time.
They live in Brooklyn.
It's not weird, I promise.
It's not weird.
It's only a little weird. Okay, it's weird.
It's not, no.
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 Anyway.
We're very excited for this.
Clearly so excited, cannot wait. We're going to take lots of mental notes and be sure to tell you guys all about it when we record after.
But. Yes. And how was your holiday?
Oh, yeah. This is our first time recording after Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Did you eat all the yummy things?
I did. What's your favorite? I think we maybe talked about this last time. But
we did.
What my favorite thing was this year was my dad has started making this aioli sauce. This, like, garlic, lemon, aioli. Mm-hmm. And to put on, like, pretty much whatever. But it's specifically for Brussels sprouts from the recipe that he made. Hmm. And, oh, my God, it's so good. And I put it on leftovers. So my mom made a new stuffing recipe this year.
Yeah.
A+. Would highly recommend. And I would, like, take a heaping pile of stuffing and, like, toss in some Brussels sprouts, maybe some butternut squash, and then heat it all up and then drizzle the aioli over it once it came out of the microwave. So good. Just like the perfect leftovers dish for me. So nice. I was very happy with it.
Yeah. Well, my mom always makes this really, really delicious sandwich spread from just any time that we have any kind of, like, leftover meat of anything. Like, it's literally the same thing. I asked her, or I didn't ask her really, but I always tell her how much I love it. And she's like, it's literally just mayonnaise, relish, salt and pepper, and I think that's it. And then, like, whatever meat you have. Yeah. And so, like, she made this really – we had chicken instead of turkey. Mm-hmm. So she made a really delicious chicken spread that I still have some left of.
It's basically chicken salad.
And it's good. Like, you can eat it in a sandwich. You can. That's what it is. But it's just, like, super simple. Oh, she usually puts a little onion in, I think, maybe. But, yeah, you can eat it, like, in a sandwich with tortilla chips, with crackers, like, anyway, with a spoon.
The best kind.
And it works with, like, turkey or beef or, like, literally whatever.
Is that what's in our fridge right now?
Yeah, in that one container.
It looked so good. I was like, oh my God, did she go and buy chicken salad?
No, it's homemade.
Delicious. I love it.
So that's one of my favorite leftovers that I always look forward to. Like,
did you and your family do anything fun while they were in town?
We did. We did lots of fun things. So we saw the Rockettes.
Yes.
And that was super, super fun.
The Christmas Spectacular.
Yeah. It was really beautiful. It's much more, like, it goes full force Christmas at the end. Like, yeah. Nativity scene. There were live animals on stage. Oh, there were, shit. Like, camels and sheep and a donkey. They, like, do the full nativity, which is beautiful. But I'm also like, you need to be, like, it's Christmas.
Like, you must be Christian to enjoy the end of this show.
There's holy water when you walk it.
Oh,
no,
my God.
Not,
oh, my
not,
God.
Not.
Oh, my God.
But it feels like it. By the time you leave, you're like, oh, wow.
Just, like,
but
douse me with holy water. Why don't you?
Yeah. But even if, like, the whole rest of the show, like, it's, yeah, it's Santa and Christmas and whatever, but it's also just a really big spectacle and beautiful and
wow,
very fun. So, yeah, we had a really great time and fit lots into the few days that they were here.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really happy for you.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fun time. I'm sorry I missed everybody.
You got to go cut your tree down, right?
I did. We cut down a beautiful canane or canaan, however you want to say it.
I think it might be canaan.
So it's Canaan in the Bible, but it's Canaan in Pennsylvania.
So
depending on who you worship, it's either the Pittsburgh Steelers or God, and it's either Canaan or Canaan.
Got it.
It's a fir tree, and we get one pretty much every year now. My mom is, like, highly allergic to spruce trees.
Oh.
To touch them, she, like, breaks out knives.
Oh, no.
So she doesn't touch the tree. She just looks at it and, like, she doesn't decorate it.
She can't, like, decorate it.
But her job is to unwrap all of the ornaments, which she loves more because she gets to, like, love them a little bit and be like, oh, I love this one. Give a little kiss and then give it to her kids to, like, put on the tree.
Yeah. That's so fun.
But so we did that, and we chopped down the tree ourselves at this really great – we've been going to this place for the past, like, 2 or 3 years. It's called Manor's Christmas Tree Farm, and it's a huge, huge business, but it's local, and it's run like a family farm. So it's not – I mean, like, it's a huge business, meaning that they get a lot of business.
Yeah.
This, like, month.
Time of year.
Yeah, this time of year.
Yeah.
But so they bring in – Amish horses and some Amish men from around the
neighborhood.
Well, because we're so close to Amish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They, like, rent out these horses, like, big worker horses.
Yeah, like the Budweiser horses.
Yeah, not Clydesdales.
That's
at least not, like, the big Clyde. Like, okay. These are, like, they're big horses, but they're not, like, tall, big.
Yeah.
Horses, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
What was that?
Whatever. Tall, big horses. But so everybody gets loaded into these horse-drawn sleighs, and you get driven out to through their little property that has a beautiful little, like, wilderness trail and, like, a little babbling brook, and all these pretty trees are turned, and, like, the colors are gorgeous until you go up the hill and you get out into the actual, like, tree farm part of it. And the horses drop you off and you get a little sled and a saw, and then you bring it back, and it's, like, a whole little, like, perfect assembly line where, like, there were easily 400 people there when we were there. Like, I mean, at least... maybe not 400 people. There were so many people.
There were a lot
of
people.
It was at least, like, 250, 300 people.
Wow.
It's just, like, it's this whole event to go get your tree. And it's just so enjoyable because everybody knows where they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's got a job. You know, like, it's impossible for you to get off the track of, like, where you're supposed to be and when.
Yeah.
And it's great. Like, it's just, like, one big... well-oiled machine, truly.
That's cool.
And everybody's really nice that works there, too, so that helps. And, like, you have enough time to, like, joke with your driver who's, like, you know, just, like, the horses know what they're doing. There's one path. It's, like, it's not hard.
Right.
But it's just this little loop, and it works, and it's just so good. They're doing such a great job, and we love it there. So
that's, my parents had to break tradition every Black Friday, like every Friday after Thanksgiving, they always go. I mean, all of us kids would go when we were growing up and whatever, but then also whoever was home with them once we got older would go with them. So they didn't go on Friday because they were here,
right.
And then they were going to go get it on Sunday once they got back home, and they had, like, freezing rain and all this stuff.
Yeah,
they couldn't go get it. So I think they're trying to go sometime this week or next weekend or something.
Right.
But we have this place that we've gone to since, like, I can remember, like, since I was little. This big farm. It's not as, like, big of a, like, thing as that, but it's this farm crazy. That we would always go to, and they've got a nice little setup and everything. But, yeah.
That's
so
awesome.
Very fun. Cool. I love the holiday times.
Yeah, me too. Big fan.
Big fan
of the holidays.
Big fan.
I love your work holidays.
Huge fan.
Cool.
All right.
Well, now that we've recapped, do you want to get started with episode 36?
Yeah. I'm going first because it's episode 36. I will just say briefly, please send us your poems for the Who's to Say episodes. Email them to millennialpoetsociety@gmail.com. You can find that in the episode description or on our Instagram or on Facebook. Look up MPS_podcast or Millennial Poet Society and click on that email button. Yep, that's what it's
about. Email button.
Email button. Send us your things. We want your unpublished or self-published works so that we can share them with the world.
Absolutely.
But yeah, now on to my poet for this week. So I discovered her on where else but the Poetry Foundation.
Of course.
But it's kind of funny because, so I think the poem that I first, like, was thinking I would do and, like, made me want to do her potentially is, so it was rain snowing yesterday,
yes.
Like a mixture. And so the poem that I saw was called Rain Changing into Snow.
Oh.
And so I was like, oh, brilliant. Perfect. Great. I don't know that I'm actually going to read that poem now. But it's interesting because it, like, it's not what you think it is with that title.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so that's how I discovered her. And so this is Connie Wanick. I think that's how you say her last name. I honestly didn't look it up. But
how did you spell it?
Wanek. Wanick.
I don't know how else you would say that.
Yeah. So she was born in 1952 in Madison, Wisconsin. The second of six children. So big fam. Hi, Delilah. Delilah is so needy right now. She wants all the attention.
Hey,
talk about me.
Hey.
So that's where she was born, but she grew up in La Cruces, New Mexico, on a farm outside of Green Bay. She attended a one-room school where a single teacher taught eight grades. There was no kindergarten, to 17 students.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the 50s?
Well, she was born in the 50s. So, I mean, I'm assuming she started school then and then into the 60s. Yeah. So, small school. she and her sisters read a great deal and drew and wrote poems and stories. So she was into the arts from a young age. And then later in high school and college. So I think that was like her grade school, like grammar school. And then she went on to like a bigger high school.
Sure.
But still probably not that big. But so later in high school and college, Connie held on to her interest in the arts, but also participated in sports, especially tennis, which she played seriously for many years, along with her brother and supposed to say father, but it says bather. Brother and bather.
Brother and bather.
Brother and father, which made me think of me because I played tennis because of my brothers and dad, and everyone was into tennis. Yeah.
Cool.
It was actually nice because, like, there's not a ton of information on her. She's a modern poet, which, like, there's not going to be a lot. But she actually had a useful bio on her website.
Well, thank God for that.
And yeah. Because I think it's so funny when people, like, don't have that much information. It's like, I want to know about you.
Or it's, like, weird. And it says stuff like, I get all those weird ones where they're like, they dream of someday owning a house on the Seine. And that's all there you need to know about them. It's like random, weird
facts. No, I want to know, like, your life.
When she was a child, she wanted to be a pony. And, like, that's it. Like, that's not useful to me, Karen. I need to know your life.
Useful.
Tell me your history.
So, she was into sports, too. She earned her BS at New Mexico State University.
What a bunch of BS.
Yeah. I don't know what she, like, the concentration was specifically. It just says that she earned her BS. Poetry, though, was a constant for her no matter her circumstances or what enterprises she found herself in. For example, she raised two children, but also worked in a family solar heating business. Hmm. And later she learned the skills necessary to restore old houses.
Oh,
and
cool.
She also worked for years at the Duluth Public Library, which she retired from in 2007. So nice. She had various jobs and everything while still writing poetry and pursuing that passion. So her poetry collections include Bonfire, published in 1997, which was the winner of the New Voices Award from New Rivers Press, and a collection called Hartley Field, published in 2002. And her newest book of poetry is Rival Gardens, a New and Selected Poems, which was published in 2016 and is the second in the Ted Kooser Contemporary Poetry Series. So those are just some of her collections. She has some more as well.
Mm-hmm.
And her poems are driven by imagery and often engage nature and natural order, which you can, I read several of her different poems, and you can definitely see that a lot in them. Poet David Orr said about, specifically when he was praising her collection, Hartley Field, he said that Wanick is from Wisconsin, but her sensibility often seems Eastern European or Scandinavian. Mm-hmm. Like Szymborska, which I guess is a person, like Szymborska, Wanick likes to end poems with poised yet cutting observations or intimations of dread that can turn ordinary activities into existential dilemmas.
Cool, cool, cool. Sounds like me at 2 a.m.
So there's that. And then poet Lewis Jenkins has also said about her poems that they take the moment, turn it upside down, open it, examine it. They give us a view from the dragonfly's eye. So she cool. makes very sort of interesting observations about life and maybe puts them in ways that you haven't thought of before.
Mm-hmm.
Wanick's poems have appeared in Poetry, The Atlantic Monthly, The Virginia Quarterly Review, Great River Review, Poetry East, Waterstone, and many other publications over the years. In 2006, U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser named her a Witter-Bynner Fellow of the Library of Congress. She also served as a co-editor with Joyce Stufen and Tom Tamaro.
Tamaro.
But it's spelled T-A-M-M-A-R-O. Tom Tamaro. Tamaro.
Tamaro.
Tamaro. I'm going to say
tomorrow. I hope it's tomorrow.
On the comprehensive anthology, To Sing Along the Way, Minnesota Women Poets from the Pre-Territorial Days to the Present, which appeared in 2007 from New Rivers Press, and which has won several awards. In 2014, she also published a book of prose, 10 stories called Summer Cars with Will-O-The-Wisp Press. Wanick was deeply honored to receive the George, this is from her bio, she was deeply honored.
I'm just inferring here, but I think she'd be deeply honored. I think she was very honored.
To receive the George Morrison Artist of the Year Award in 2009, which recognizes an individual artist whose body of work has made a significant contribution to the arts in northeastern Minnesota.
I hope that's the full title.
Unfortunately, no. She now lives with her husband Phil and their children in Duluth, Minnesota.
Oh, Duluth's the worst weather-wise.
Well,
I've never been there, I don't think. My dad goes there for work all the time, and it's like frequently 1 degree there. Like
frequently 1 degree.
Yeah. Just the worst.
So that's Connie.
Cool. Thanks, Connie.
There were Canny.
Canny Wanick. Well, that's such a Midwestern name.
Yeah, Connie.
My name's Canny Wanick. Like, it's just like
Minnesota.
I'm from Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
I'm Canny Wanick. That's cute.
So there were several different poems that I really liked about, like, that she had written. And I might read more than one, but Delilah's being noisy drinking her water.
From her
cave. Attempting to drink her water.
Do you guys, we have a weird cat.
She drinks so weird.
She like licks it up once and then just licks the air for like 3 more licks. Is that normal? Write us if, does your cat do that too?
And she also just lays, like lounges next to her water while she drinks it.
I think it's because it's too low for her. I'm wondering if we should lift it up.
I think she quite enjoys laying next to it. I think she's quite happy doing that.
She does look happy.
So the one that I'm going to read, I think, is called Splits.
Splits.
Yes. The world of my youth was divided into girls who could and girls who couldn't slide casually to the floor, one leg aft and one fore, while their faces retained a sprightly cheer. All summer, all year, they stretched the critical tendons, descending in increments, the way the willful enter a frigid lake, their arms folded across their chests, their backs burning in the sun as their legs numb. Yet the splits seemed less a skill than a gift of birth, Churchillian pluck combined with a stroke of luck, like a pretty face with a strong chin. One felt that even as babies, some girls were predispositioned.
Truth, though. It's just how your body's made.
Yeah. And I don't know why I like that so much. I think, well, just because
hard to that, though.
Yeah. Like, and I think it speaks to, like, people, not just, like, little girls thinking about splits, but also just people feeling like, oh, God, some people are just born to be, like, good at all these things. Or, yeah. Like...
Or when you look at somebody and you're like, God, you were just born pretty, weren't you?
Right. Like, no matter how hard I try, I'm never going to, like...
I'm not going to have your cheekbones ever.
I'm not going to have it.
I'm never going to have your cheekbones. I'm looking at you, Mark. No matter how hard I contour.
I mean, I'm contouring too.
Yeah, but still. You know, some people are just born.
I'm never going to have Delilah's soft little fur.
I hope not.
I'm just saying. Some people are just born with it.
Maybe she's born with it. Maybe she's a cat. Delilah. It's Delilah's brand.
So yeah, I just really liked that. This one doesn't speak so much to the like natural sort of language that I was talking about in her bio and that some of her other poems use, but I think it definitely like it sort of has that double meaning where it's like it's talking about schoolgirls trying to do splits, but then also speaks to people who feel like they're just no matter how hard they try, they're just not going to be able to like do certain things or other people. It's just going to come more naturally and everything.
Well, I think it also is kind of a natural poem because it's speaking of the natural way of humans. Mm-hmm. And like it's that the natural instincts to crave to be good at something that everybody else is good at. And the competitive, the natural competition that happens between youths and the youths, you know.
And there actually is one more that I want to read for you. I think this is the one that I actually thought I was going to read and then I forgot. I've got like four different tabs open right now. So Splits is the first one that I clicked on. And I do like that poem, but I also like this poem. It's called, her titles are often, like, pretty simple, too, I've found. So this one's called Radiator. Mittens are drying on the radiator, boots nearby, one on its side. Like some monstrous segmented insect, the radiator elongates under the window. Or it is a beast with many shoulders, domesticated in the Ice Age. How many years it takes to move from room to room? Some cage their radiators, but this is unnecessary as they have little desire to escape. Like turtles, they are quite self-contained. If they seem sad, it is only the same sadness we all feel. Unlovely, growing slowly cold.
That's pleasant.
Isn't that interesting? That last stanza, it starts at the turtles, they're quite self-contained. That last stanza makes me think of the quote that the one, like, critic said about how the ends of her poems often have cutting observations or intimations of dread that can turn ordinary activities into existential dilemmas.
Yeah, truly. I mean...
Yeah. If they seem
sad... What a way with words she has.
If they seem sad, it is only the same sadness we all feel. Unlovely, growing slowly cold. She's just talking about a radiator, but then it's like...
She's like, I am the radiator.
Fuck. I am. We are all.
I love that.
The radiator.
I love that, though. Because that's very much our brand as millennials.
Yeah.
To be like,
I am a radiator just growing like, slowly cold in the corner of the room.
But not even that. But like, yes, but not even that. But just to be like, hey, this thing is happening.
Yeah.
And also, my life is in flames. It's fine.
It's fine.
We're also all growing cold and in the corner, aren't we?
Yeah.
Right? Guys, back me up.
Right, right. Yeah. So, yeah, those are a couple poems by Connie Wanick. And she's got many more that are really good. I literally had so many that I was trying to choose from. I was on the Poetry Foundation looking at all the poems that she had, and I would click on another one and be like, oh, well, maybe this one. Oh, but maybe this one too.
Yeah.
Oh, but I like that one too. I'm like, I just need to stop opening them up because I'm just going to not, it's going to make it even harder for me.
Yes.
So yeah, go check her out. She's got lots of poems on the Poetry Foundation, and she's pretty cool.
Thanks, Connie.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll take a short break and be back with Emily.
It's me.
Yay.
I'm so hungry.
I need to eat more than just chips and salsa after this.
I'm gonna make chimkin nuggets. Chimkin nuggets. I'm sorry. I'd like to apologize.
I don't apologize.
Okay, so I'm gonna make this as quick and efficient as possible because
that was three things.
Because this person has so much to them.
Okay.
I'm gonna like
try to condense it.
Try and condense as much as I can.
Okay, cool.
I'm not even going to get close, but I'm going to try. Okay, we've talked about this person, not as a poet yet, but like we've mentioned him a lot because he's an influence on a lot of people.
I thought you were about to say he's an influencer.
Because he's an influencer. You know him. You love him. William Carlos Williams.
Yay. Yay. Wait, that's so cool.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to do him. We just have been talking about him so much, and honestly, I wasn't planning on doing him today, but I was doing my research on my lunch break, and I was so hungry. And so I was like, I don't know, like, poems about food.
Uh-huh.
It's just, like, typed it in on Poetry Foundation.
Yeah.
And this whole collection came up, poetry about food.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, interesting.
Interesting. Okay.
And one of his that I'd heard before, oddly enough, on a This American Life episode,
This is This American Life.
So actually, so the poem I'm going to read to you, I'll explain it, but like it had its own segment. Like, you know how like This American Life is cut up into acts, act one, act two, act three?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the acts of this episode was the title of the poem, and it was people getting their chance to like they read the poem. And then listeners and famous writers got a chance to, like, write their own version of this poem.
Oh, interesting.
And for this episode, because it's, like, basically being, like, sorry, not sorry, I did this thing, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'll read it to you. It's great. I can't wait for you to hear it. It's going to be great. Yeah. Okay. But to get there, let me tell you a little bit about him first.
Yeah.
William Carlos Williams, born September 17th, like our dear friend Amanda.
Yeah.
1883. Not like our dear friend Amanda.
No, a little bit older.
A little bit older. In Rutherford, New Jersey.
Rutherford.
William Carlos Williams is a Puerto Rican, was a Puerto Rican American poet and physician.
Hmm.
His work is closely
associated. Doctor.
Yeah, but it doesn't say doctor in front of his thing.
Oh, so maybe he was like, it was before they had like medical school probably.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he went to college. He didn't go to like an additional school, but it was medical school, but it was.
It was like back in the day when it wasn't like
you didn't have to go to get like a, right. Like
yeah.
you studied medicine and that was the only thing you studied after high school.
I'm a doctor now.
Yeah. So
great.
His work is closely associated with modernism and imagism, which if you recall imagism, we discussed it briefly when we were talking about Gertrude Stein.
Mm-hmm.
And in that era, like, Ezra Pound comes into play. I'll talk to you about him, too. Okay.
Cool.
Great. He was born the first of two sons to an English father and a Puerto Rican mother of French, Dutch, Spanish, and Jewish ancestry.
Wow.
He lived and grew up in New Jersey. Having passed a special examination, he was admitted in 1902 to the medical school of the University of Pennsylvania, from which he graduated in 1906.
Hmm.
So that was his college schooling. He went right from high school
Like, I'm
into
done now.
Medical school. But he had to pass a special test.
Yeah.
But it was like, that was all, yeah.
He was like, finals.
Yeah, exactly.
Hashtag finals week.
Upon leaving university, he did internships at both French Hospital and Child's Hospital in New York before going to Leipzig. Mm-hmm. Leipzig?
Yep.
For advanced study of pediatrics.
Cool.
During his life, Williams was a medical doctor, a poet, a novelist, an essayist, and a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
Along with Ezra Pound, Williams was one of the leading poets of the Imagist movement and often wrote of American subjects and themes. Though his career was initially overshadowed by other poets, he, like many of our other MPS alums, became an inspiration to the Beat Generation in the 50s and 60s. He was known as a revolutionary figure in American poetry, yet, in comparison to artists of his own time, Williams lived a remarkably conventional life. Mm-hmm. That's what he said.
Oh, he said that.
His style of poetry relied heavily on his patience, like his...
people.
Yeah, like his, he practiced medicine on. Yes.
Okay.
His patients. The America around him.
Is wearing.
The America around him and his own imagination for inspiration. Often domestic in focus, Williams' poetry is characteristically honest, which I think you'll find very clear in the poem that I read to you.
Okay.
Poetry Foundation states, quote, "There is no optimistic blindness in Williams, though there is a fresh gaiety and a stubborn, invincible joyousness," which I really like and I admire. William Carlos Williams had a family that provided him with a generous background in art and literature.
Great.
His father's mother, coincidentally, was named Emily Dickinson.
And
she was a lover of theater, and his own mother painted. His father introduced him to Shakespeare and would read Dante and the Bible to him as well.
Great. Just, you know.
Yeah. Just, you know.
Casual light reading.
The three big greats. Dante, the Bible, Shakespeare.
Shakespeare. I was like, what is the third?
Shakespeare. Okay.
Shakespeare.
Of course. So his parents, like, when he was younger, like, before high school, they were like, oh my God, the arts are great. You're going to love the arts. It's so fun. Yay.
Yay.
And that was good. But Williams enthusiastically pursued his interest in math and science throughout most of high school. But later on in his high school years, he took an interest again in language and felt for the first time the excitement of great books. Yay. It was around this time that he wrote his first poem. Nothing he published, but just like he tried writing poetry.
This was in high school?
Yes.
Okay.
The only bad thing was is that his family was like, oh, shoot, we just hoped that it'd be like a hobby.
That you would just like
read poetry. But like you're not going to amount to anything if you study this. And so Williams, he says he lived much of his early life filled with terror. That's his word.
Wow.
According to James Breslin for the Poetry Foundation, part of this terror came from the rigid idealism and moral perfectionism his parents tried to instill in him.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. So it was partially thanks to this strict upbringing that he went straight on to med school after high school without even thinking. He was like, I'm just going to do it. My parents want me to, so here I am.
I'm going to be a doctor.
Which is like such a common
path for so many people. Yeah.
So he used his college experience.
Not us.
Whoops. He used this college experience, though, as a means to create creativity, though, instead of, as his parents may have wished, a means for success.
Okay.
So the conflict he felt between his parents' hopes for him and his own artistic impulses were mirrored in Williams' poetic heroes of the time, like John Keats and Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
Williams' friendship with Ezra Pound began in college and marked an important point in the young poet's life. Aside from the poetic influences, Pound introduced Williams to a group of friends, including poet Hilda Doolittle, or HD, and painter Charles DeMuth, who shared the kinds of feelings that in Rutherford had made him frightened and isolated. So, like, he went to college in Pennsylvania after being like, nobody understands me.
Mm-hmm.
And college was like, we understand you. which is like every good American kid going off to college from a small town. So that's great. It was this feeling of freedom that persuaded Williams to join the Imagists, as they, as Ezra Pound and his like followers called themselves.
Posse.
Yeah. They broke from the formulaic poetry of their past by stressing a verse of swift, uncluttered, functional phrasing. Very, very clear and prominent in a lot of his work.
Mm-hmm.
Williams' first work, Poems, published in 1909, was conceived prior to the Imagist influence, though, and that contrast is, like, shocking. Like, you can totally see the difference.
Whoa.
By 1917 and the publication of his third book, Al Que Quiere, Williams began to apply the Imagist principle of direct treatment of the thing. He also decided to use this material he knew best, which, as a doctor, was the people of Rutherford, his patients. Williams had described that his poetry came from his experience being present at deaths and births, at the battles between daughters and mothers, and all of the life in between. Some of his poems were first written on prescription blanks, others typed in a few spare minutes between patient visits. His work did more than fuel his poetry, like his work as a physician.
Yeah.
Did more than fuel his poetry. It allowed him to, quote, write what he chose, free from any kind of financial or political pressure.
Hmm.
What a great gift, you know? But that also made him live kind of like enough life for two people, which was something that was just so beautifully stated in his bio on the Poetry Foundation website. I highly recommend you read it. Like, it's lovely. A lot of it is right here, but like the way that they described, it was basically like Alexander Hamilton. Like, how do you write like you're running out of time? Like, it's, he just like,
he wrote so much.
He wrote and worked so much. Like, he did enough for two lifetimes in one.
Right.
Like, how did he sleep? Where did the time go? How did it happen?
Yeah.
Williams' deep sense of humanity could be felt in both his work in medicine and in his writing. His wife, whose name is Flossie.
Flossie.
I went to church with a Flossie back
such
in Ohio.
An old name.
What a sweetie. She said, he loved being a doctor, making house calls, and talking to people. A friend described him as, and this is just such a lovely way to be described, an immensely complicated man. Energetic, compassionate, socially conscious, depressive, urbane, provincial, tough, fastidious, capricious, independent, dedicated, completely responsive. He was the complete human being, and all of the qualities of his personality were fused in his writing.
Hmm. Wow.
Like, what praise, just from a friend.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I saw my pediatrician while I was home at my uncle's harvest party.
Crazy.
It was really funny.
You were like,
I was like in another area. My mom's like, someone wants to see you. And I came over and she looked amazing.
Yes.
Dr. Nio and her husband who I met. And they like looked so great. And she was so stylish and cute and like whatever. And I'm like, oh my God.
I'm all grown up. Look. Yeah. You did it.
Made me think of that.
That's funny.
Yeah. You did it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You helped. Thanks. Williams' lifelong quest was to have poetry mirror the speech of the American people. His point was to speak on an equal level with the reader and to use the language and thought materials of America in expressing his point of view. In 1920, William Carlos Williams was sharply criticized by his peers when he published one of his more experimental books, Cora in Hell, Improvisations. Pound called the work incoherent, and H.D. found it flippant.
Mm.
Ouch.
Yeah.
3 years later, he published Spring and All, which contained classic poems of his, such as By the Road to the Contagious Hospital and To Elsie. Some people argue that, like, his most, like, prominent work came out of this book, and it's called Spring and All. However, in that same year, T.S. Eliot, it's just like this time period was filled with poets.
Crazy.
Like,
yeah.
T.S. Eliot published The Wasteland during this time, which became a literary sensation and overshadowed Williams' in every possible way.
Yeah.
Even though he did pretty well.
It right, was like not because his work wasn't good, no, but just because T.S. Eliot was like
just like T.S. Eliot was like groundbreaking for mm-hmm. more of the common folk.
Right.
Because Williams was still doing stuff that was technically very experimental.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote, critically, Eliot returned us to the classroom just at the moment when I felt we were on a point to escape the matter much closer to the essence of a new art form itself, rooted in the locality which should give it fruit. So he was like, I'm bummed because this guy beat me.
Yeah.
And did exactly the opposite of what I thought everybody was ready for.
Yeah.
Although he respected the work of Eliot, Williams then became openly critical of Eliot's highly intellectual style of poetry and was like, dude, nobody gets this.
Yeah.
Just write what you mean. Which, like, same. Like, I get it. Though some of Williams' best poetry came from Spring and All, he did not release another book of poems for nearly 10 years.
Wow.
One reason was probably Eliot's success. Some people also say that it was because of Williams' success, and that Spring and All was, for the few people that read it, his best work. Mm-hmm. And so he was like, I could never outdo myself again. Yeah. Like, it took a while.
Right.
But so he began writing prose. And in it, he concentrated on the subject of America. In 1939, in a letter, Williams explains, quote, of mixed ancestry, I felt from earliest childhood that America was the only home I could ever possibly call my own. I felt that it was expressly founded for me personally, and that it must be my first business in life to possess it.
Hmm.
Sounds like such a white man when he says that, though, which is terrible. Mm-hmm. But I think it's great. Like, he was like, he was a mixed American wanting to find his own space mm-hmm. in life, which right. is great.
Yeah.
So Williams' novel trilogy, White Mule, In the Money, and The Buildup, also focused on America and one family in particular, which was his wife's family.
Mm-hmm.
He first thought of the idea for White Mule because he wanted to write about a baby. He had delivered more than 2,000 in his career, which is insane.
Yeah.
And he heard stories from his wife about her babyhood. Her story was one of an immigrant family growing toward success in America. So mm-hmm. that's what he wrote. Between the years of 1946 and 1958, Williams' modernist epic collage of place entitled Paterson was published. It was an account of the history, people, and essence of Paterson, New Jersey. I think I'm saying that right. It's one T.
It's Paterson.
It is Paterson. Yeah. That's what I thought. He also examined the role of the poet in American society and famously summarized his poetic method in the phrase, no ideas, but in things, which is from a poem, A Sort of Song.
Mm-hmm.
Later on in life, Williams mentored and influenced many younger poets, but none more than Allen Ginsberg.
Mm-hmm.
Williams included several of Ginsberg's letters in Paterson, stating that one of them helped him inspire the fifth section of that work. Williams also wrote the introduction to Ginsberg's first book, Howl and Other Poems, in 1956.
Mm-hmm.
Williams suffered a heart attack in 1948 and after 1949, a series of strokes. Severe depression after one such stroke caused him to be confined to Hillside Hospital in New York for 4 months in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
And then on March 4th, 1963, he died at the age of 79 at his home in Rutherford, New Jersey.
Mm.
So, like I said, there's like so much more that we could possibly talk about with him. But I'll leave it at that for now.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to read you his very short little poem. It's called This Is Just to Say, and it's the one that was found on This American Life. That was the first time I came upon it. Well, it is about food, kind of. Yeah. Mm. And I really like it. It's got some attitude to it in a subtle way, which I love.
Fun.
Okay. This is just to say. I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were delicious, so sweet, and so cold. And that's it.
Yeah.
And so it's like just a quick way. And he's just like, he doesn't say sorry.
No.
He demands, forgive me.
Right.
In fact. So he's like
asking for forgiveness rather than permission.
Right.
He's like, I did it. And I know you were probably saving it, but like they looked real good.
Yeah. And they were really good. Which is just like, sorry, not sorry, man.
Yeah.
Which I hate that phrase, but also it's so perfect to define this. And so I had heard the This American Life episode and I like tried to write my own and I couldn't find it. I was going to see if I could find it, I would like read it to compare. But yeah, it's just this like, it was such a cute prompt, I thought too, for them to like reach out to their listeners about.
Right.
And to see, like to listen to all of them. It's such a good episode. And I just really loved the poem. I thought it was like everything that his poetry tried to be. It was in the American speech. It was on the level of the reader.
Yeah.
It was snarky. It was sharp. It was a slice of everyday life, you know? Like, oh, it just captured so much in it, and I loved it. So.
I love it so much.
So that is William Carlos Williams. Amazing. At least the tip of the iceberg on him.
Right.
He's great. Just like a truly fascinating man, and his poetry is so, like, he really did influence a lot of the Beats poetry movement.
Yeah.
But I think he's still inspiring people today, like, easily.
Yeah.
So, I mean, clearly he inspired even me to try and write my own version. So,
right.
I love it. Yeah.
Amazing.
So that's him. And
so cool.
That's it.
Thank you.
Of course. So that's it from us. We want to give a special shout out to Zach Adkins for our intro and outro music. Thank you so
very much.
And as always, please take a look at the link in the bottom of our show notes. You will see that link. It will take you to a support page where you can donate as little as 99 cents a month.
Dollar menu.
Donations.
Yay.
Yay. Thank you so much for those who have already. That little bit goes a long, long way.
It really does.
Helps us get better equipment, a better space, a better... Not better. You're the best. Somebody who's professionally able to.
Someone who's got some more time on their hands.
To actually edit our podcast.
Yeah.
And that's, it's just a great way to say thanks for your hard work, Emily and Mark. And we really appreciate it.
And we appreciate you.
But if you can't give at this time of your life, which is fine, you can help us out by rating and reviewing this podcast, especially on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. I believe we are now on Podcorn, which is something new. I just saw it in our email today.
That's an ad thing. I don't think it's for people to listen to.
We're on all the good apps, you know, Stitcher, Google, Apple, you know the drill. Check us out, give us a rating, and that's really it. We really appreciate you guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.